The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week, I started talking about the five hindrances, which are qualities of our mind or states of mind that get in the way for us. They obstruct our ability to have our minds settle down. They tend to agitate our minds so that we don't feel very happy. They get in the way of our well-being. They get in the way of our ability to concentrate. So these five states are sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt. Last week I kind of did an overview of them, and I'll do just a little bit of that tonight because I know some of you weren't here last week, so I just want to give a little bit of an overview, not very long. So I mentioned that these five hindrances kind of block our ability to be concentrated. They block our ability to just have a sense of well-being, actually. They run counter to, they get in the way of some beautiful states of mind that support our ability to be balanced and at ease with our experience as it is, that support our ability to settle down, to become more present, more aware, and more concentrated. And those states that the hindrances oppose, there's another list called the Seven Factors of Awakening. And those include mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, concentration, tranquility, and equanimity. And so these two lists are seen to kind of be opposites of each other. They oppose each other. There's one teaching in which the Buddha talks about feeding and starving these states of mind, that when we are feeding the seven factors of awakening, we're starving the hindrances. And when we're feeding the hindrances, we're starving the seven factors of awakening. And this brings to mind an analogy that the Buddha used around the hindrances, which I mentioned last week, that of a banyan tree, which is a tree that starts its life in support on another tree, and its roots then begin to create a lattice work around the trunk of the other tree and begin to strangle it. So the banyan tree competes for nourishment with the host tree and eventually strangles the host tree. And the hindrances kind of function that way. When we nourish the hindrances, it strangles the ability of our mind to be present, balanced, connected, open, concentrated. So we need to choose wisely what we nourish in our hearts and minds. So tonight I'd like to talk about the hindrance of sense desire. And I'll just go through these over the weeks. I may finish with sense desire tonight, I may not, so we'll see how far we get in this discussion. So sense desire. The Buddha compared sense desire as, in terms of its ability to obstruct the clarity of our mind, he compared it with a bowl of water that's been laced with dye. And that if that bowl of water is sitting there and it weren't laced with dye and it were sitting there still, you'd be able to see your reflection in that bowl of water. But when you put the dye into the water, you might be able to see the reflection, but you're so distracted by the swirls of dye that you don't see the reflection. And that's kind of how sense desire works for us. We get pulled in to these beautiful colors, these beautiful experiences, and we don't really see clearly. We don't see what's actually happening because we're living in the swirls of dye. So sensual desire has to do with being attached to sensual pleasure, being attached to having nice things around us or nice experiences, pleasant food, pleasant clothes, pleasant objects around us, pleasant ambient temperature, pleasant whatever is your favorite pleasant thing. It's not the pleasant thing itself that's a problem, because life presents us with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. We can't stop life from presenting us with pleasant experience. That's not the goal here, to stop the pleasant experience. The problem, as the Buddha explains it, is that we get attached to pleasant experience. We begin to feel like if we don't have pleasant experience, if our life isn't managed such that we have a kind of a continual stream of pleasant experience, then there's something wrong. Either there's something wrong with the world or there's something wrong with us. And so we get attached to having beautiful experience, pleasant experience, sensual pleasure. We get attached to that. And we suffer when things don't go that way, when we find that we can't just continually create our experience to be just pleasantness. We suffer. Or we have something that we love and it disappears. It's impermanent. It goes away. As the Buddha says, separation from what is loved is suffering. So it's this attachment that gets us into trouble. It's not the pleasure, the sense pleasure itself that gets us into trouble. It's our relationship to that sense pleasure, the kind of neediness that we have around that sense pleasure, the way in which we find that our identity gets defined around being the one who can create the sense pleasure or provide the sense pleasure. So we get caught by this sense pleasure. The Buddha compared sense pleasure to a dream. I'll read you what he said. Suppose a man dreamed about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of them. So too, householder, and householder just refers to somebody who is a lay practitioner, not an ordained monastic. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus, sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is still more. So what he means there is basically, if in a dream we have this experience of pleasure and then waking up, they're gone. There's nothing there. So there's just nothing there. The dream state is one of being immersed in pleasure. But when we come into awakening, There's nothing there. And that's kind of the way sense pleasure is. It's impermanent. The actual experience of sense pleasure is so fleeting. And actually, when we begin to investigate it, we see this for ourselves. He also compared sense pleasure to borrowed goods, that we can enjoy borrowed goods. We can enjoy using them, but somebody comes and takes them back at some point. So again, it's not a problem to use the borrowed goods. The problem comes when we feel bereft when they're taken away. So this attachment to sense pleasure is this sense desire, this hindrance. And it gets in the way in our meditation. You know, if we're in sitting meditation, sense desire gets in the way because, you know, we may be sitting in meditation and be fantasizing about doing something other than sitting in meditation. You know, our mind is creating sense pleasure for us and taking us out of being present, being here in the moment. So sense pleasure, sense desire takes us away. Sometimes it takes us away because our bodies feel uncomfortable. We want to imagine ourselves someplace else. So in terms of the settling our minds into a concentrated state, sense pleasure is one of those movements that pulls us out into fantasy, for example. So in working with sense desire, the instructions that the Buddha gave, and I reviewed this somewhat last week, he had several aspects to instructions on working with sense desire with mindfulness. The first aspect of it is recognizing when sense desire is present, no sense desire is present. It's that simple, really. The instructions in the sutta where he describes this don't say, you know, when sense desire is present, beat yourself up for having sense desire. He says, just know that it's present. So it's not, we don't need to berate ourselves for this. This is a very normal experience that everyone has. He wants us to recognize it, to be aware of it, turn our attention towards it. So this is a huge part of working with this hindrance, getting familiar with it. What is sense desire? To me, it has this feeling of being pulled. You know, it's like being pulled out of yourself towards this thing. It feels like a magnet almost, being pulled towards whatever it is that you want. It might be, you know, we might be pulled towards material things, or, you know, the latest iPhone or something, you know. We might be pulled towards ideas or meditative states that we've read about. We might have sense desire for, you know, this desire for wanting something that we've heard about but we haven't actually experienced. And actually, in looking at sense desire, I've seen a lot of sense desire actually doesn't have so much to do around actually having the thing itself, but it's more around the person I think I'll become by having that thing. So I'll be respected by my peers if I have this thing or present myself in this way. Or I'll be more powerful if I have this thing. So it gets hooked in very strongly with identification, with being something, not just to ourselves, but to people around us. And that's a very strong hook for us with sense desire. So looking at that aspect of it, it's not always that. Sometimes it's just, you know, the luxuriating in, you know, 500 thread count sheets, that feels really good. but, you know, sometimes it has to do with, you know, oh, if I have that new Prius, then everybody's going to think, yeah, she's a really, you know, green person. You know, she she's not driving one of those gas-guzzling cars, you know. So it becomes connected with identity, the things that we want. So keeping that in mind while you observe sense desire. So getting familiar with sense desire, some of it has to do with getting familiar with the stories that your mind tells around it. That we can start to recognize sense desire by recognizing the way our mind talks to us. Oh, if only I had that thing. If only, that's a good one to recognize. If you hear if only, sense desire is probably operating. You know, things would be great if, you know, recognizing the stories around sense desire. And then learning too, what does it feel like? What does sense desire feel like? Getting familiar with the feeling that comes with those thoughts. And we're so much in our thoughts. We're so used to living in the world of our thoughts. And actually, part of the way sense desire works is that we have these thoughts about, oh, wouldn't it be great if I had that new iPhone? We project our mind into the future at a time when we will have that iPhone. So we create a fantasy. And then we live in that fantasy, which, because we're in complete, you know, control of that fantasy, it's very pleasant. So we not only want the thing, the pleasant thing in the world, the actual thing, but we create a pleasant fantasy that reinforces that sense desire. So that pleasant fantasy comes up around the wanting, and that fantasy actually obstructs or obscures, let's say obscures, what it feels like to want something. We don't actually recognize what it feels like to want something because we're so caught in our thoughts about how great it's going to be once we get it. And so the turning of our attention towards the experience of desire is a big part of the practice. And this can be challenging because the fantasy of the thing that we want is pleasant. And when we turn and pay attention to sense desire, we find that it is unpleasant. The feeling of wanting something is a feeling of lack. It's a feeling of insufficiency. It's a feeling of suffering. So right now, just close your eyes for a second and give yourself a few moments to think of something that you really want. Let yourself conjure it up in your mind. And allow yourself to want that thing in your mind. Now we're trying to construct the feeling of wanting here. So allow yourself in the bringing up of this thing in your mind to feel that, yes, you do want this thing. You can almost imagine reaching out to get it. Now turning towards, what is that feeling of the wanting? What is that? Can you feel that, what it feels like to want that thing? Letting go of any fantasies about having it, the actual feeling of the wanting. And now see if you can imagine yourself letting go of wanting that thing. Letting go of needing that thing. And see what happens in your experience. Is there a change? Can you feel the wanting dissipate as you let go of thinking about this thing. So you can open your eyes. So I'm curious, what did some of you feel in that experience? Did anybody have a sense of the feeling of wanting? Yeah.
Release.
Release? When?
When I let go.
When you let go. Okay, so you felt a sense of tightness around the
wanting.
The wanting.
Wanting.
Yeah, you found felt a sense of tightness around the wanting. And then there was a feeling of release.
And sadness.
Sadness with the letting go?
No, with the wanting.
Oh, sadness with the wanting. Oh, interesting. That's interesting. Okay, thank you. Anyone else willing to show over here? Could you pass from hand to hand? That might be the easiest. Sorry.
I was so preoccupied with the wanting, I forgot about the letting go.
And what did the wanting feel like?
It was kind of a desire.
But desire is a mental thing. Did you feel anything bodily?
Yeah, I felt a little uptight, but that's been something that's been persistent throughout this afternoon, so it was hard for me to tease that apart.
I see. But you got kind of caught into the thought, thinking about wanting the thing that it was hard to let go, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, Anyone else?
The wanting manifested itself for me in my stomach as a sort of a knotted kind of craving feeling.
And were you able to let go? Was there a sense of the releasing of that?
Didn't get that far.
Didn't get that far, okay. But you definitely felt
the
knotting, okay.
So I felt this weird strain in my throat, this like muscular, really, really uncomfortable sensation, and then I wasn't able to let it go. It's just, okay, now imagine that I have this thing, and I don't need it. Oh, it's still there.
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, let's just take a minute now to just, let's see if we can let go of this, if some of you are still in the in the area of being caught. You know, just take a couple of deep breaths, allowing yourself to relax a little bit. Connecting to your body and releasing some tension through your body. Maybe taking a couple of deeper breaths and consciously connecting to the relaxing aspect of the out-breath. Okay, well, we'll see how that goes. I don't want you all caught in tightness for the rest of the talk. So another tool in our toolbox for working with sense desire and for any of the hindrances, actually, is to use the noting when we notice it, turning our attention towards it and using the noting, desire. Desire is present. And that's in fact what the sutta says. When one recognizes sense desire is present, one knows desire is present in me. And that's said in quotes, actually, in the sutta. It's as if it is a thought arising in your mind. Sense desire is present in me. That's how it is expressed in the sutta. So it's kind of as if the sutta is encouraging us to reflect with a thought. Desire is present in me. So this is a way we can use noting. And that noting practice, it's not a heavy thing. It's very light. It's just a very light whisper of a thought in the mind to support the mind's recognizing what's actually happening in the present moment. Just a light, gentle recognition of what you're noticing. So turning to the desire itself. Withdrawing attention from the thing that we desire. This is the movement of mindfulness. So this turning towards, it serves a couple of purposes. First of all, we actually get familiar with the actual experience of desire. We recognize that it actually doesn't feel very good to have that feeling of wanting. And also, you know, the one of the things that the Buddha says nourishes sense desire is the attention to a desirable object or the attention to a pleasant object. Unwise attention to a pleasant object, he says, is what causes sense desire. And so when we turn our attention towards the sense desire itself, we're taking our attention out of the thing that is nourishing the sense desire. We're turning towards the feeling of desire, but it's no longer being, it's like that banyan tree again, you know, the nourishment, the thing that makes the sense desire stronger is the attention, the unwise attention to that pleasurable object. So we turn our attention instead towards just noticing what is present for us in this experience of sense desire. And in that movement, we are now strengthening the factor of mindfulness, one of the seven factors of awakening. We're nourishing mindfulness by attending to sense desire. So that simple movement takes us from nourishing a sense desire, nourishing a hindrance, to nourishing a factor of awakening. Simple movement of turning towards the sense desire. So paying attention to what it feels like, not only in the mind, the feeling in the mind, the thoughts it produces, but also the bodily sensations. It can, as many of you mentioned, it can have physical manifestations. The feeling of wanting can produce tightness, tension, holding in various places in your body. And also turning our attention to the body helps keep us out of the thoughts and the fantasies around the object that we desire. Again, that turning towards the experience with mindfulness, cultivating the quality of mindfulness, nourishing mindfulness instead of nourishing sense desire. The second aspect of the instructions on paying attention to sense desire in the Buddha's teaching on this is to notice when sense desire is absent. When is sense desire not present? And the instruction goes something like, when sense desire is not present, one knows sense desire is not present in me. Again, very simple instructions. This is really a helpful practice. It's a very helpful practice, particularly when we start to recognize how frequently we're in the state of desire. As we start to become familiar with how often these things come up for us, we start to feel like, well, they're always here. They're always present. Or perhaps we really strongly identify with something that we want. So, you know, if there's something that we really strongly want, noticing when that strong wanting is not present, because it isn't always present. It's impermanent. It comes and goes. It's a mental phenomenon that has conditions associated with it. So it's not always there. So if we can recognize when it's absent, it supports our recognition of the impermanence of the sense desire itself. So it helps to kind of break through that idea that, you know, it's always happening, or I'm never going to be rid of the sense desire, or the identification around something that we really want. We realize we're fine when it's not there. The freedom from sensual desire is likened to being free from debt. So, you know, we take out a loan to buy something or to have something that we want. And yet we're having to pay every single month for that thing. So it's not free and clear. You know, We don't have that pleasurable thing which we've taken out a loan for. We don't have it free and clear. And that's the way sense desire is, when we're attached to those senses, those sense pleasures. It's like paying back on a loan with this feeling of wanting, that unpleasantness of wanting. And we're increasing that wanting. It's kind of like needing more and more pleasant things, needing to take out more and more loans in order to have the things we want, and going deeper and deeper into debt. And so, you know, imagine being really deep into debt and then suddenly you're free from debt. That release is akin to the feeling of being released from sense desire. In my own experience, watching this, and you can actually watch this, it can take some persistence and some patience, but, you know, pick something. Pick something when you're caught in some kind of sense desire for something relatively harmless, like, you know, a piece of chocolate, wanting a piece of chocolate, or, you know, driving by a Starbucks. This happened to me one day a few months ago. I was sitting in a traffic light and there was a Starbucks over there. Decaf latte, that would be nice, popped into my mind. There's this wanting. It's like, the light was red for a little while, so fortunately I had some time to watch. You know, I just watched this feeling of wanting. And then, you know, just driving by the Starbucks, not turning in and getting the decaf latte, as soon as the Starbucks was out of my vision, the wanting disappeared. You know, observing that kind of thing, it can feel, if you're very, very present and really attentive to the experience of wanting, the feeling of wanting feels like you're in a vice grip, like you're just clamped down. And that release feels like you've been released from a vice grip. So actually, that points to one of the misunderstandings that we have about sense pleasure. That we think that the pleasure we get is from having the things that we want. We think that the reason why we like having, you know, the things that we want is because they're just, you know, they're pleasurable. That we like the pleasure of having the things that we want. But when we really start to watch this wanting and see the wanting release, we really see actually the larger part of the pleasure of getting what we want is that the wanting disappears. That when we get what we want, we no longer have that feeling of lack, that feeling of insufficiency. And that's actually what keeps fueling the whole cycle of wanting more and more. We don't recognize that it's the ending of the wanting that has made us feel so good. We think it's the having what we want. So we construct another thing to want so that we can get that, so that we can feel the wanting release and have that thing. It's quite remarkable when we actually start to explore our minds and explore the wanting, that it's really the letting go of the wanting that makes us feel at ease, brings a kind of a happiness. And so there's another way. There's actually another way to deal with sense desire. And that is not necessarily to get what we want, but to hang out with sense desire long enough to watch it disappear. When the sense desire disappears, the feeling of lack, the feeling of insufficiency disappears. The suffering disappears. So I'm going to say just one last thing. I say this with a little caution There's a traditional teaching in the suttas around the antidote to sense desire. If you're really caught in sense desire, the recommendation is to pay attention to something unbeautiful, or pay attention to the unbeautiful, unattractive aspects of what you were drawn to. And typically, I mean, this is primarily, the commentaries say at least, this is primarily referring to contemplating the unattractiveness of the physical body by contemplating a corpse in stages of decay, or by contemplating your body as just parts, you know, and envisioning your heart and your intestines and your feces and your urine and, you know, just envisioning all the various aspects of your body. It's like, you know, all that stuff is in there, and most of us are kind of repelled by thinking about the fact that all of that stuff is in there. But, you know, wrap it up in the skin and hide it all, like putting a beautiful package, a bow and, you know, beautiful wrapping paper, and it's beautiful. We think it's beautiful. So these are some of the recommendations, particularly around desire around the opposite sex. And I mentioned this with caution, but I'm going to say a couple things. One is that we have to look at the context in which this is taught. And that is, the main people that this was taught to were young, probably 18 to 25-year-old men who had, you know, taken robes and were trying to be celibate for the, you know, first time in their lives. And not an easy thing to do. So it was, you know, seen as a way to kind of cut that desire in the mind. So I just wanted to put that out there, but we can use a little bit of this teaching. I mean, the teaching mentions reflecting on the unattractive aspects of what we want. And so we could use a little bit of reflection. You know, this thing that I want is impermanent. The pleasure that I get out of this thing will last 2 seconds. This piece of chocolate, whatever it is. Actually reflecting on what is it that we are getting out of this, this experience. And is it really as much as we are imagining it to be? So to kind of reflect on that. And this is a truthful, you know, this is actually reflecting on the truth of experience. You know, if you're reflecting on impermanence, you're reflecting on a truth. This isn't like the sour grapes Aesop's fable, you know, where the fox was leaping and trying to get the grapes and couldn't get the grapes and then finally gives up and walks away and says, oh, they were sour anyway. You know, that's not a reflection of truth. That's a reflection of, you know, I didn't get that thing, so I'm going to turn it into a bad thing. This is reflecting on the truthful aspects of the thing that we want. It's impermanent. How much satisfaction will it actually provide? So the primary teaching around this is to get to know sense desire, to observe it. It's not to try to stop sense desire or to repress it. That's a form of desire in itself. It's a form of actually an aversive kind of desire, trying to stop something that's a very natural process for us. What we're trying to do in our mindfulness practice is to get to know how our minds work. Get to know how sense desire operates for us. What kinds of things draw us? What kinds of things do we want? How much do we really want them? What is it that we want about them? Is it the thing itself? Is it an identity? Is it so that I look good to my friends? Is it so that I feel pleasurable? What is it? How does it work in our minds? We don't have to stop acting around sense desire, but we are asked to observe it. Especially as lay people. Now, as monastics, they are more asked to not act around certain kinds of sense desire. They're asked to not eat food after noon. So the sense desire of wanting food in the evening, they have to not do that. They're asked to engage in celibacy. So they have to let go of the sense desire of the physical body. As lay people, we're not asked to do that, but we are asked to observe. What is this sense desire? One of my teachers from Burma, Sayadaw Utejaniya, for the first many years, he's been a monk for about the last 13 years, but he was a lay practitioner for the first, you know, since he was about 14 until he ordained, about 13 years ago. So he came late to the monastic life, and a lot of his practice was cultivated in daily life. So he has a lot of these great daily life stories. And he tells one about sense desire. He says, yeah, you don't have to, you know, as a lay person, you don't have to stop doing the things, but you do have to pay attention. He said, you know, one of the things I really loved was boxing. I like to go watch boxing. And so I noticed that desire come up in my mind, and so I did it. He said, I got on the bus to go to the boxing match, and the bus was full and crowded and hot, and it was unpleasant. I was noticing the unpleasantness of that. I got there, I had to stand in line to get the ticket, stand in the sun, it was really hot, that was unpleasant. We got inside, and it was hot and sweaty inside, and that was unpleasant. And then they started the boxing match, and watching the people hitting each other, I saw that they were suffering. And I had to leave. So this was his explanation. I think he said he never went back to boxing again. That kind of cured him of his desire for boxing, to pay attention to what happened to him. That's what we're asked to do. Be mindful. Okay, so what do you have to say? What are your thoughts on this? Yeah, behind you.
I'm just wondering how you separate mindfulness from self-centeredness.
What do you mean by self-centeredness?
Well, sometimes you can be in a situation such as, I was thinking about when you were talking about the bus and the heat and all this, and sometimes you need to tolerate situations that are extremely uncomfortable for, well, not boxing, but a good cause. So how do you, when do you ignore it, and when should you be mindful, I guess?
Well, the basic instruction is to be mindful all the time. As much as you can, be mindful. I mean, we may have to go through unpleasant experience. I mean, there may be unpleasant experience in doing something that is worthwhile. Going to help disaster relief victims, you know, you have to endure the travel to get there, et cetera, all of that. You know, there's unpleasantness there. I mean, if you're mindful, though, of unpleasant experience, it's just unpleasant experience. We don't have to be reactive to that unpleasant experience. Yeah.
It's kind of funny. I just got a new Droid Incredible, which is like the... and I love my phone very much. And I have not lacked for wanting it. And I was thinking, I left it at home today, and I was miserable. You know, I sort of like... My boss tried calling me, and I said, my phone's not here. It's at home in Boulder Creek, you know? But the other thing that's interesting about, and I just mentioned this because this is maybe too techie, but there's an app in the phone that's called the Mindfulness Chime.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes off about every hour or so. And I'll be sitting in my office, and this thing will go, bung. And it really does call you to attention, you know, in terms of what's going on. It's
yeah,
cool.
That's great. It's a great tool to have that. So there, right, you know, there right, are benefits to technology.
Anyway, that's my story.
Well, you know, the wanting that you describe and the having the thing, There's one teaching, and maybe I'll talk about this next time. I'm not here next week, but the following week when I return. There's a teaching that the Buddha talks about sense pleasure, and he says to explore sense pleasure in terms of three things: the gratification that it provides, the danger that it offers, and the escape from that danger. So, you know, we don't have to get rid of sense pleasure, but to reflect on it in terms of these three things. You know, there is gratification. There is a form of happiness that comes from having things. And like you say, the benefit of having this thing that will produce the chime that helps you wake up. So there is some benefit. Being very clear about what the benefits are, what the gratification is, and the instruction is to know how far that gratification extends. Does it really do it for you? Look at that. So that's actually, I have a whole talk on talking about those three aspects of looking at the gratification, the danger, and the escape. And so maybe I'll talk about that next time instead of moving on to the second hindrance, just to be a little more complete about this topic. So thank you for that. Anyone else?
I'm not sure that this fits, but my attachment to listening to you and my attachment to the Dharma, I want to be here, and I'm so freezing that I have to go through that. I'm thinking I'm going to get up and leave because I'm just freezing. And so I'm just looking at that. I don't know. I think that's not sense desire. Is it being attached to the Dharma and wanting to get this?
Oh, that part, yeah, okay. Well, the part about the being freezing and wanting to get up and leave is more of aversion. It's more the ill will side of things. But let's make a note and make it 76 next time instead of 74. It is a little cold in here. You could actually go turn it off now if you want. The other part where you talked about the desire to be here, to listen to the Dharma, to hear the teachings. That's not sense desire. Sense desire is more about the wanting of pleasant things in the environment, you know, the senses of the tactile senses. And there is a teaching where the Buddha talks about kind of three levels of pleasure. There's the pleasure of sense pleasure, and then there's the pleasure of states of consciousness that come to us through meditation. And then there's the pleasure of understanding the Dharma, of, you know, deeply understanding the Dharma. And that last one is the highest pleasure there is. And it's not an unwholesome pleasure. So part of the path towards letting go of sense pleasure is to begin to recognize there are more valuable things to bring into our lives that bring us pleasure. Rather than having things, there's and it's still a form of desire in a way, but it's kind of like we transcend the desire for things through a kind of a more refined desire for the states of mind that come with meditation, the kind of relaxation and release and letting go that happens, the peacefulness that happens. And then there's an even more refined pleasure that happens with the deep understanding of the Dharma. That really provides the base for us to just be at ease with whatever is happening. And that's said to be the highest happiness.
The sense desire is I'm very attached to the aesthetics here,
uh-huh,
and this empty space. Uh-huh. To me, this is just...
Ah, interesting. Seeing. Okay, so there is some sensual aspect to it.
Oh, it's so big. I mean, if you saw, I've got so much clutter. you know? Mm-hmm. And then to come to this place, and it's so beautifully appointed, everything, the flowers, that just soothes my soul.
And there's another teaching.
Oh, what is that?
Keep finding teachings on these things. There's another one that's a really, this one may be helpful for you to reflect on, because it's exactly what's happening for you. That when we come into meditation, it can be really helpful to recognize, and this points to the absence again, what agitation is absence in coming into this space. So in your case, there's the absence of the agitation of the clutter. And that can help your mind to settle down, to connect to the fact that there's the space. So that's a kind of a skillful recognition of the absence of the things that cause disturbance. Actually reflecting on that as we begin a sitting. What is absent here? What normally causes disturbance for me, and what is absent here in this time? And for you, it's the clutter. So that's can be actually a very skillful reflection. And it's 9:00, so we need to stop. So I'll see you in a couple of weeks.